Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So today we're reading Canto 6, Chapter 4, Text 46 from the Hamsaguya prayers.
Tapo. Tapo me ridayam brahmams. Tana vidya kriyakriti. Angani kratavo jata. Dharma atma savasuraha.
Translation. My dear Brahmana, austerity in the form of meditation is my heart. Vedic knowledge in the forms of hymns and mantras constitute my body, and spiritual activities and ecstatic emotions are my actual form. The ritualistic ceremonies and sacrifices, when properly conducted, are the various limbs of my body. The unseen good fortune proceeding from pious or spiritual activities constitutes my mind, and the demigods who execute my orders in various departments are my life and soul. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Sometimes atheists argue that since God is invisible to their eyes, they do not believe in God. For them, the Supreme Lord is describing a method by which one can see God in his impersonal form. Intelligent persons can see God in his personal form, as stated in the Shastras. But if one is very eager to see the Supreme Personality of Godhead immediately, face to face, he can see the Supreme Lord through this description, which portrays the various internal and external parts of his body. To engage in tapasya, or denial of material activities, is the first principle of spiritual life. Then there are spiritual activities, such as the performance of Vedic ritualistic sacrifices, study of the Vedic knowledge, meditation upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. One should also respect the demigods and understand how they are situated, how they act, and how they manage the activities of the various departments of this material world. In this way, one can see how God is existing and how everything is managed perfectly because of the presence of the Supreme Lord, as the Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 9, text 10. Maya dakshena prakrita suyate sacharacharam. He tune nanena kuntaya jagat vipari vartate. This material nature is working under my direction, O son of Kunti, and it is producing all moving and non-moving beings. By its rule, this manifestation is created and annihilated again and again. If one is unable to see the Supreme Lord, although he is present as Krishna in his various incarnations, one may see the Supreme Lord's impersonal feature according to the direction of the Vedas by seeing the activities of material nature. Anything done under the direction of the Vedic injunctions is called dharma, as described by the orders carriers of Yamaraj. Canto 6, Chapter 1, Text 40. Veda pranihito dharmo ya dharmastad viparyaya Vedo Narayana Sakshat Svayambhur Iti Surshruma. That which is described in the Vedas constitutes dharma, the religious principles, and the opposite of that is irreligion. The Vedas are directly the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayana, and are self-born. This we have heard from Yamaraj. In this connection, Srila Madhvacharya comments, Tapo Bhimani Rudrastu Vishnuri Dayam Ashrita Vidyarupa Tatai Voma Vishnostanum Upashrita Shrigaradya Kriti Gata Kriyatma Pakashasana Agneshu Kratava Sarve Madhya Deha Chadarmarat Prano Vyas Chita Gato Brahmadya Svashu Devataha. The various demigods are all acting under the protection of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And according to their various actions, the demigods are differently named. Translation: My dear Brahmana, austerity in the form of meditation is my heart. Vedic knowledge in the form of hymns and mantras constitutes my body. And the spiritual activities and ecstatic emotions are my actual form. The ritualistic ceremonies and sacrifices, when properly conducted, are the various limbs of my body. The unseen good fortune proceeding from pious or spiritual activities constitutes my mind, and the demigods who execute my orders in various departments are my life and soul. So we continue along here, Nahamsa Guya prayers being offered. And yesterday, of course, Bhavananda Prabhu, my God brother, gave a very wonderful class, I think inspired everyone so much. So I have to follow such a class. But here I see one thing, particularly in these purports. You see, day after day, Srila Prabhupada is quoting so much. Huh? He quotes from Bhagavad Gita. He's quoting Srila Madhvacharya, and all these things, of course, didn't happen by accident. One thing, if you see the different DVDs they have now with Srila Prabhupada, I know there's one, it took place in Melbourne, Australia. And Prabhupada was speaking to a professor, actually I think he was speaking to a politician, a lawyer. And he began quoting from Bhagavad Gita. And of course, I was sitting over on the side. And then he quoted one verse from Bhagavad Gita, and he quoted the first line, and he said, "Find that verse." So then I would have to go through. This is 1975. And I would have to go into the Bhagavad Gita. And of course, at that time, Prabhupada started doing that very often. He would do that because it was after 1973 that Srimad Bhagavatam, Srimad Bhagavad Gita, they all had the Sanskrit verses in the back. They would have the first line of each verse. So as soon as something was quoted, you could find what verse that was. So over and over, he would do this when I was in Bhaktivedanta Manor, and he would do it in Australia, wherever he would go. He would, just like a lawyer, because Prabhupada always said, these are our law books. So we don't just speak, we're not just speaking from our imagination, we're not making things up. You know, Prabhupada would say all the time that we haven't manufactured anything, this Krishna consciousness movement, it's not something new, it's been there from time immemorial. So he would often quote because he would want to show authenticity of what was being said, not that he was just talking and telling some stories, but he wanted to show the authority of the Shastra. And Prabhupada, the pure devotee, Srila Prabhupada had complete faith in the Shastra. So he said, these are our law books. And he wanted that everyone, when they spoke with authority. Not just that we talk, make things up. It's okay to speak from realization, put it in our own words, that's required. But it has to be authoritative words. And not imagination. He would say, we're just delivering the mail. So all these verses you see in here, when he's quoting Madhvacharya, he quotes Sridhar Swami, Vidyabhushana, so many ones he's quoting. He's getting this from books that he has beside him. Every night, Prabhupada would translate. He would translate Srimad Bhagavatam. He would translate Chaitanya Charitamrita. As I said, while everyone was sleeping, Prabhupada would get up 1 o'clock in the morning, 1:30 in the morning, and he would sit down just on a cushion on the floor, and he would have a small desk in front of him and a little lamp. Didn't have big chandeliers he would turn on. Just the whole room was dark, but there would be the small desk lamp over the books. And he would have his Srimad Bhagavatam. At that time, Prajumna, most often Prajumna was his Sanskrit editor. And he would carry the books. Prajumna was very, liked books very much. And whenever you see Prajumna, if he comes here, you'll see he always has so many books he brings with him. His luggage is, you know, one shirt, one pair of khaki pants and books. That's his luggage. So even when we were with Srila Prabhupada, Prajumna, we would have our suitcases, and then Prajumna would bring his books with him because he was afraid that they might get lost. So he would have shoulder bags. If you see some pictures, you'll see Prajumna, one shoulder bag, two shoulder bags, three shoulder bags. And Prabhupada would look and say, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, my books, you know. These are my books." So Prabhupada, of course, called him Panditji. He was our Panditji. And sometimes Prabhupada would laugh and he would call him Banditji. You know what a bandit, in America, a bandit is like your criminal. So he would sometimes in joking call him Banditji. He said, always carrying so many books. He said he doesn't read them, he said, but he's carrying them. But he actually reads them as well. I just saw him recently. I was in New York for the 40th anniversary of 22nd Avenue, the very incorporation of ISKCON. And I was fortunate enough to be there. And I stayed in a most amazing place. I stayed in the sanctuary. Some of you may know what the sanctuary is. You have 22nd Avenue. And just the next block around was the sanctuary. And this was the facility that the disciples of Kirtanananda Maharaj had gotten years ago, even while he was in jail. And they were keeping it for him. Anyway, it's some five-story building. But somehow or other, Kirtanananda Maharaj was there. Jagya Purush was there with his band of brahmacharis. Now they have so many brahmacharis that are going out every day, like you do here, preaching, distributing books, doing Harinam. So they were in there. And beautiful deities are there. And Prajumna was living in the Brahmachari ashram. And he has his little closet, just like you all have here, your little closet. Prajumna had his little closet. And he opened it up and he has his pair of khakis. He has his shirt and it's filled with books. You know. So I gave him one of my books. I said, "Read it sometime, Prajumna." "Yes, okay," he said. But every day after Mangal Arti, we would just go up to the ashram and talk. I hadn't seen him in so many years. And Prajumna, when I first came with Prabhupada, he was Prabhupada's Sanskrit editor. And so we have a nice relationship that we've... And we really had a nice time together. But he would carry these books for Srila Prabhupada. And of course, the one book, it was known as the Black Bhagavatam. And that's what it was, the Black Bhagavatam. And this Bhagavatam was no bigger than this book. And it had only the Sanskrit shlokas. Every shloka from all 12 cantos were in this book. So Prabhupada would have that. That would be in the center of his desk each morning as he would translate. And then Prajumna also carried these, they were much bigger, almost like letter-sized paper, other hardbound covered books. And they were green covers. They were called the Green Bhagavatams. Now these Green Bhagavatams, there was one Bhagavatam for each canto. And of course that was also all in Sanskrit. But they had the Sanskrit verses, and they also had commentaries by 10 different acharyas were in there. Like you see him quoting from Madhvacharya, Sridhar Swami. Sometimes you'll see he'll mention, Sridhar Swami says this, and this one says this. And so these are all coming from this Green Bhagavatam. And so these were the books Prabhupada traveled with. So when he sat down every morning with that dictaphone machine, you saw the Garga Muni describing how he bought that dictaphone machine. You saw that video I think last week they presented the video for Prabhupada's disappearance day in Vrindavan. And he was saying how expert Prabhupada was on this. This was a state-of-the-art dictaphone machine from Grundig, German, you know, German dictaphone machine. And Prabhupada immediately knew how to operate this. And from my room in the servants' quarters, I would very often wake up when Prabhupada did his translating work because I was a light sleeper. And I would hear Prabhupada, and you could hear the clicking of the dictaphone as Prabhupada would speak into it. And he would go over the translation. He would give translation. He would give word to word. And then he would rewind. You could hit it down, and then you would rewind. And he would listen to what he said. And then he would go on, and he would start to give purports. But he would go over all these. It wasn't that he just sat there in some state of samadhi and things just channeled through him. But no, he worked. As Bhavananda was saying yesterday, Krishna consciousness doesn't mean we just sit back, chant Hare Krishna, and everything's happening around us automatically. We work very hard for Krishna. And Prabhupada, every day, day and night, worked very hard. And to put these books together, as I was saying, he described these books, how special these books are. He put them together with such care for us, for all of us, future generations. As we know, he said they would be there. These would be the law books, not for mankind. Everyone quotes this. Prabhupada said, for the next 10,000 years, no one can find it anywhere written down. But everyone's convinced that Prabhupada said it here and there. I also am convinced, although you can't find it in Veda base anywhere. But I saw practically Prabhupada showing us how to use these books as law books, to speak from authority, to give Krishna to everyone in an authoritative way. And one thing I see that's so nice, first I'll say again how when Prabhupada translated, he did it with such care. You know, so much, such profound thoughts Prabhupada put in every word. As he said, each and every word Prabhupada picked so carefully for us because he knew how important this was. Now imagine, this is coming here in India, like you see, for hundreds of years, thousands of years, these Sanskrit texts were there. But he had to take these texts and put them in to the English language. And then from there, they were going to be translated. We see 50, 60, 70, 80 different languages all over the world. So Prabhupada took this responsibility very seriously to present Krishna, right, as he is. Right? Bhagavad Gita, as it is. Srimad Bhagavatam, as it is. So carefully. Prabhupada said in Vrindavan, of course, we know he did the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam in three volumes. And he said he did that first canto in such a way that everything is in there. Because he didn't know what might come later. Prabhupada was always completely dependent on Krishna. He thought whenever Krishna wants, he would always say, I'm an old man, you know, in my 70s. Krishna can take me at any moment. But when he did the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam in Vrindavan at Radha Damodar Temple, he said he put everything in there so that we could understand fully Krishna consciousness. And as he also said, whenever there was a question, he would always say, read my books. Everything is in there. All the answers are in my books. You can understand everything. As Bhavananda was saying so nicely yesterday, glorifying Jaya Prabhupada, glorifying Srila Prabhupada, saying, he's given us everything. We don't have to go anywhere else except to Srila Prabhupada. That means Srila Prabhupada's books, his instructions. He's given all of it to us. It's not that you have to complete Prabhupada's books and then find somewhere else to go to bring you to the next level. Imagine to think like that. As he was saying, Prabhupada himself spread Krishna consciousness to every town and village. He was a very specially empowered devotee of the Lord. So his level of Krishna consciousness is unsurpassed. So that's all available to us. To think that there is somewhere else to go, it's incomplete. Somehow what Prabhupada gave us was incomplete. It's blasphemous. And to just remain chaste to Srila Prabhupada, all success will be there to any one of us if we take to the process seriously, if we follow Srila Prabhupada's instructions. So, I got to hear every night, sometimes waking up and going back to sleep and dreaming and just hearing Prabhupada's voice giving this Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita. I was so fortunate that they do that. Huh? That's one karmi method. You know, you lie down on your pillow with your cassette under your pillow and you have it say things into your head and you learn by osmosis, you know. You take in this good instruction. So I'm hoping that even while sleeping, just hearing Prabhupada's words, that oral reception, every day hearing from Srila Prabhupada, every night hearing from Srila Prabhupada, do this translation work with such care, huh? Such gravity, and as he said, with his own ecstasy. When Prabhupada read these books, he became ecstatic. Once in Australia, we were in Melbourne, Australia, and this was 1975. And at that time, Prabhupada was translating the fifth canto, and it was all about the cosmic manifestation. And for us in the West, this, for many Westerners, these were very controversial subject matter, all about the planets, the sun, where the sun is, where the planets are. Of course, now we bring in Sumeru Mountain, Rahu planet, Ketu planet, all these things we had no understanding about. And Prabhupada's taking this information from the literature, and he's 100% sold on what he reads in Srimad Bhagavatam. Didn't matter anything else, whatever these mundane scientists say. He said he didn't care for them. We heard so many walks. I would Bhakti Swarup Damodar in Los Angeles. So many walks I was there as they were going. Prabhupada didn't care for anything they said. He would say one day they'll say one thing, and then the next day they change it. Right? 5 years later they'll come up with a whole different theory. And he said to the devotees, they can say so much information. But what's the basis of their information? Their very first basis is, what do they think? They think they're these bodies. They don't even understand their spirit soul. And from this is their foundation, I'm this body. So their whole foundation is completely bogus. And from that they build on all their theories. We know their theories, they admit their theories. So they're building on that. So Prabhupada never accepted. From the very beginning, Prabhupada wrote, do you know Easy Journey to Other Planets? Who knows what year that book was written? Easy Journey to Other Planets. 1961. Like 1958 or so. Yeah, 1958, 1959 was the very first, of course, here in India. And that was when Prabhupada said, one friend said to him, you're doing this Back to Godhead magazine. He said, but magazines, people, they put them aside when they're done and they get thrown out even. He said, you should write books. So then Prabhupada wrote the small book, Easy Journey to Other Planets. But in there, Prabhupada says that it wasn't possible to go to the moon. It wasn't possible to go to other planets by some material process. This was in 1958, 1959. So now it was 1975, and Prabhupada's in Hawaii, in this very beautiful 5 acres of land, a nice temple, Ambarish purchased for him, just so he could translate. Everything, when Prabhupada was here, it was always facilitate Prabhupada to translate books. He would always say, this is my business. This whole ISKCON society, that was side business. So many disciples. That was the distributor's books. He said, my temples are like book warehouses from which book distribution goes on. That was the business of temples and the business of his disciples, his followers. But his main business was to give us books, to translate books into English language. So always, he would always say, please relieve me of this management. He would say, this headache, this management headache. He would say to the leaders, you please become qualified, relieve me of this burden so I can do my translation work. Of course, Prabhupada never gave up either side. He never gave up the management of the society because he wasn't going to see things disintegrate in his presence. That he had to do. So he did everything. He did his translating and still he managed the ISKCON Society. Still he trained up so many devotees, so many followers to try to make them expert devotees, expert managers. He did everything all the time. So he said, this was my service. It was never, as I said, what is the difficulty? Nothing was a difficulty. It's our service. We don't see difficulties. As soon as you see something as a difficulty, then you're thinking of your own sense gratification, huh? Because it's not pleasing to you. I'm not enjoying this service anymore. I've done it for so many years. It's so difficult. It's boring. I want to do something new. You were thinking, me, I don't like this. But service is to the spiritual master. Service goes to Krishna. So it's never like that. It's never difficult. It's always what we're eager to do. We would always say that in the 70s when Prabhupada was here. Devotional service is joyfully performed. So that's our process in performing devotional service. It's joyful. So Srila Prabhupada, everything he did, as I would say, Prabhupada never had any anxiety. He was always happy because he was serving his spiritual master. He knew his spiritual master was pleased because he was carrying out his instructions. So in 1975, we were in Melbourne, Australia. Srila Prabhupada was there, and he had two of us with him, myself and Paramahamsa. You remember Paramahamsa Swami? I talk about him sometimes. Tomorrow we'll talk about Paramahamsa Swami some more. And so Prabhupada called us into the room one day. Because I was saying, an easy journey, Prabhupada had said that not possible to go to other planets, not possible to go to the moon, because then they were talking about it. So now in 1975, Prabhupada was talking to Hari Sari in his quarters in Hawaii Temple, a very beautiful room. And he said, just like in our easy journey to other planets, I have mentioned this. It is not possible to go to the moon planet. And Hari Sari kind of looked. And Prabhupada looked at him. He said, you have read the easy journey? And Hari Sari said, well, he said, maybe 3-4 years ago. He said, but I don't recall that statement so much, Prabhupada. And Prabhupada looked. He said, get me an easy journey. So Hari Sari got him an easy journey to other planets. So Prabhupada was sitting and he was reading for one day, 2 days. Every now and then he would read. And then he called Hari Sari back into the room. He said, it's not in here. So it just so happened that the editor of that easy journey to other planets is Hayagriva. I agree that he edited. He was the very first editor for Srila Prabhupada with Bhagavad Gita. So he had been away for some years. I agree with struggled. We struggled from 1970 on. He was struggling. So he was away. He would come back. He was away. So he came to see Prabhupada while he was in Hawaii. So he just happened to be there. He would say by chance. Of course, we know nothing ever happens by chance. Nothing is by accident. So Prabhupada called. He said, have Hayagriva come in. So Hayagriva came in. And he said, so I have put in this easy journey to other planets. It is not possible to go to the moon and not possible to go to other planets by material means. He said, but it's not here. I said, yes, Prabhupada. He said, well, he said, after the moon landing, when was the moon landing? Whatever it was, 1969 or 69. So he said, after that, he said, it was such a controversial thing to say, he said, that I removed it. Prabhupada was furious. Imagine, he took this out of Prabhupada's books. Prabhupada was never into covering over, as we say, what's the word, you know, making things palatable so people would accept. Prabhupada only wanted to deliver the absolute truth. In his books, we get the absolute truth. So he chastised him severely. How could you take that out? And I agree, he was defending himself. He said, well, I just thought it was the best thing to do. And so then he left the room. And he was back in the servants' quarters. Hari Sari was there. And they were having a discussion. And Hari Sari said, I agree, but he said, you can't do that. You can't take things out what Prabhupada says, you know. That's not the kind of editing Prabhupada wanted. He wanted to make things said nicely. You know, if he thought if the English was not just perfect, make it in proper English so that everyone accepts it nicely. But not to add things, not to remove things. So Hayagriva had such a difficult time understanding this point. You know, he still thought he had done the best thing. So some time went by, and finally, in Hayagriva, he went back into the room, and he apologized to Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was compassionate, merciful. He said, that's okay, he said, but put it back in. So, because Prabhupada never accepted this moon landing. Now it's almost, it's common everywhere. In America, they have 2-hour-long documentaries showing all the ways in which they have manipulated pictures and shadows are in the wrong spot. And there's the flag waving and there's no such, there's supposedly no atmosphere on the moon, so the flag couldn't be waving. They've shown all these ways how it was something that was staged by NASA, by the U.S. government. So now it's almost common knowledge that, and they never speak about it even for years and years. But Prabhupada, from the very beginning, he challenged them all. He didn't go to the moon. And for devotees, some of them, Westerners, us Westerners, Americans, we found this difficult to accept. I never did find it difficult. But many of them found it difficult. And even one of Prabhupada's servants left because of it. He was Prabhupada's personal servant. And when Prabhupada said we didn't go to the moon, he just couldn't accept it. And as soon as you can't accept one thing, your whole faith is shaken, huh? So severely that he left Srila Prabhupada's personal service. He left the ISKCON Society. But Prabhupada never would withdraw such a statement. So over and over he would say these things. So then in 1975, Prabhupada's in Australia, and on the morning walks he's talking because he's reading every day. He's reading about where the moon is, where the sun is, how many yojanas and miles are between the moon and the sun, and Mount Sumeru, and all these different things. And he would talk about it on the morning walk, and he would ask questions, and I would very rarely get involved because it wasn't a subject matter that I was very accomplished with, nor did I want to get into a debate about Prabhupada and science and the planets. But Paramahamsa, he would give the scientific viewpoint, you know, the scientists would say this and the scientists. And I found that very difficult because sometimes you would think you were taking the position of a scientist, and then Prabhupada would start chastising you and saying, why don't you believe? He would say, and then you would become all, you would think that you were just playing the antagonist, but then he would attack you. So you must have faith, he would say, and you'd think, oh, did I lose my faith somewhere? So in the one morning he called us in, he had been translating. So very early in the morning he called us in, and he had just done the verses where it was describing that the moon is farther away than the sun from the earth planet. And he just looked at us and he said, "Now I am convinced that we never went to the moon." He said, "I always knew it wasn't possible." He says, "But now here is evidence from the Shastra." He said, "So it wasn't possible." But when he said it, as he said, he was convinced. He had complete conviction. See, and this is what we have to do. We all have conviction about something. We're all convinced about certain things. But our conviction has to come from Shastra. It has to come from Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. This is the basis of our knowledge. This is why a devotee, he doesn't know anything else except for what he gets from his spiritual master, except what he gets from the Shastra. And as soon as Prabhupada read that, that's all he needed to hear. You couldn't do any, there was nothing you could do, there was no evidence, because this is truth. This is absolute truth. And everything else you hear on the outside, it's all nonsense. It's all theory, and it's all based on, "I'm this body." Everyone's speaking on that assumption, "I am this body." So we're getting this knowledge from Krishna, Krishna's pure devotees in the disciplic succession. So to see Prabhupada have that conviction, this is what I got to see every day, Prabhupada's conviction in Krishna consciousness. When he said something, it was with full realization. It wasn't, theoretical. It wasn't theoretical knowledge. So he saw this knowledge there, and that was it. And he was quite happy, very happy to see that. And then he would say, when devotees, they would ask for different explanations, he would say, "We don't." He said, "This is just short. This is just a summary," he said, "of how these things are happening. There's just a few chapters devoted to this." He said, "But this isn't our business." He said, "And this isn't our interest." He said, "Our interest is developing love of Krishna. This is our interest." He said, "We're not so interested in these things as devotees." He said, "But it gives some summary of how things have taken place." So then we're still there in Australia, and every day this is going on, and Prabhupada's reading these things, and he's speaking. But many times you'll find that Prabhupada's Bhagavatam class, he would touch on the subject matter that he was translating. So he might be giving Bhagavatam class from second canto, third canto. But if he's doing translation work in the sixth canto, he would bring up topics. Prabhupada was a person. So things he discussed in conversations, things devotees would say on morning walks, Prabhupada sometimes would bring them up in classes in a philosophical way. So he would also bring up things he was reading in Chaitanya Charitamrita, translating, things he was doing in the Bhagavatam, translating. So now, each day I'm massaging Prabhupada just before lunch. This is in Melbourne or Sydney, or maybe it was Perth. I think it was Perth. So these topics are going on, and they're very sensitive topics, again, for us Westerners, because he could see that some of his disciples, their faith is not all that strong, and they have faith in, we'd been brought up, you know, we were brought up in school, learning how all the planets were situated and where everything is. And so it's what you learn as a child, it's very difficult now to break these habits. So as he would have these conversations, he's convincing. He's working on convincing his disciples what's going on. So anyway, one day in Perth, Prabhupada's sitting by the pool. This was like a little cottage, a vacation house. Perth is like Bombay, is a beach town. It's right on the beach. And I'm massaging Srila Prabhupada. It's getting late, huh? And I'm massaging his back with mustard oil. Just massaging, doing my service, minding my own business. And Prabhupada said, "So," he said, "what do the material scientists. What do they say? He said, we say, you can only understand who your father is by your mother. Right? You don't know who your father is unless your mother said, this is your father. She knows who the father is. Right? So he says, we know who the father is by our mother. He said, so what do the material scientists say? So each day this has been going on, all these battles, and I was thinking, well, what do I say? I said, you have to accept that your mother is telling you the truth. And now I'm behind him, massaging. He got very upset. He says, she's your mother. Of course she must be telling the truth. He said, how can you say that? He said, the Shastra is our mother. We have to accept the Shastra. He said, if you don't accept, he said, then you have no business here. He said, you must accept. And he's yelling at me. I was just taking the role of a mundane scientist. And he's yelling at me. And he said, all right, that's all. So now I'm massaging, and I'm all nervous, and I'm starting to sweat under the sun, you know. And I think, what did I do? I didn't do anything. And I'm massaging him. And he said, okay. He said, so. He said, we understand who our father is through the mother. He said, this is how we understand. So he said the same thing again. What do the materialists say? So I was not very intelligent. And I'm thinking, well, what do I say? He's asking again. And I didn't think what I said was flawed. I didn't think there was anything wrong with it. And I'm thinking, well, he's asking again, so let's do it again. He wants to have a discussion with the material scientist. So I said the same stupid thing again. And I said, well, we have to accept that the mother is telling the truth. He starts yelling, you must accept the truth. He said, you have to accept immediately from the mother became the Vedas. Huh? The mother became the Shastra. So he says, you have to accept the Shastra. He said, how can you not accept? He said, if you don't accept, he said, then what are you doing here? He said, if you don't accept, leave. He's telling me to leave. I was just massaging him. And he's saying, if you don't believe the Shastra, then you have no business here. He said, then go. He said, do you accept? I said, yes, Prabhupada, I accept. He said, okay then. He said, this discussion is over. He said, I don't want to speak about this anymore. And I'm going, good. I'm thinking to myself, good, because I don't want to speak about this anymore. Because I don't know the right answers. So then I just kept massaging, and he didn't say anything the whole rest of the massage. So now, this is another massage. I had a few of these massages. Prabhupada's just not speaking to me, and he's just sitting there. And I'm thinking, oh, Prabhupada's so angry with me, you know? So then massage went by, and I cooked his lunch. Everything went on the rest of the day. He didn't say anything. So then in the evening, I give Prabhupada massage in the evening, and he's in a small room. Prabhupada had a small room there, just a bed and a light. And he's lying in bed, and I'm massaging his legs, massaging his feet. I'm feeling very happy now. I forgot about my big difficulty in the daytime. I was ready to go jump into the pool and drown, you know. So I'm massaging him, and he said, so. He said, some years ago, he said, I had one servant. He said, and when I told him that we didn't go to the moon, he said he couldn't accept it. He said, and he left. And then he looked at me, so much compassion. He said, you're not going to leave, are you? And I said, oh no, Prabhupada. I said, that's okay. I said, I believe we can go to the moon. He said, good. He said, I don't want you to leave, you know. So then I realized all this. Prabhupada was so concerned as he was describing all these things about the universe, about the moon, the sun, because he knew us Westerners, it was a stumbling block for many. And Prabhupada would say, if you don't understand, he said, then just move on. Some point you'll understand. But if you don't understand something you're reading, then don't try to, with your mind, don't try to come up with some mental concoction. He said, just go on. He said, one day you'll understand. So Prabhupada was actually so concerned for me that he wanted to see that I remained with him, that I didn't leave because of all these things. So then I could even understand when, in the afternoon when we had this discussion, what turned into a little argument, Prabhupada just wanted to see that I was accepting everything very nicely in the Shastra and that I wasn't becoming weakened, you know, wasn't going to be going away because I didn't accept. So I was very happy. But that was also Srila Prabhupada's. But I'll never forget that day. It was one of my most difficult days with Prabhupada. He kept chastising me. And I thought I was being like all my God brothers. I was just coming and saying, yes, well, they say this and, you know, they say that. But it didn't work for me. I failed. And that's why I didn't do it very often, because I always knew that potential was there. Yeah. A devotee on one of those walks, Prabhupada was talking about Bhagavad Gita, and someone said, well, you know, some of them, the scientists or some of the theologians, philosophers, they say the Bhagavad Gita came from 2,000 years ago, because they like to put it with inside the Christian calendar, you know, after Jesus, that he squeeze it in there within the last 2,000 years. And Prabhupada looked right at him and he said, so you don't accept Bhagavad Gita was there 5,000 years ago? But he didn't think he was saying that. He was saying some philosophers. See, that's, so you had to be very careful with Prabhupada. You never knew what would make Prabhupada say a certain thing, and then you would think, what did I do? You know? Prabhupada could see right through us. As we would say, Prabhupada could see us. Prabhupada understood us. So I didn't speak about anything I was going to today. I even took notes. I was so concerned after Bhavananda's wonderful class yesterday. I said, how do you follow a class like that? You know. But so I took some notes. But anyway, any questions or comments? Anything? It's Chaupati. No one has any questions here anymore. Everyone... Yes. Microphone for him.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Prabhuji, day before yesterday we were having a class, Brahmachari class, and a devotee was mentioning that these two incidents, Bhavananda Prabhu and yourself spoke about Prabhupada not being in anxiety at all. Absolutely, he was involved, but at the same time completely detached from all of this. So this devotee was asking something to the effect that how can we actually understand that because generally... when we take up some service, we become, so much anxiety is there.
So much anxiety, yeah.
So.
Yes. Some anxiety is there. Of course, it said like the pure devotee, it's described how he can, you know, withdraw his senses at any time, huh? Just like the tortoise, you know, and he's completely unaffected. So again, externally, if we saw Prabhupada, we would think that there was so much, sometimes so much, put Prabhupada in anxiety. But again, there's a purpose there. These modes are there. One can become passionate. You know, goodness is there, passion. But they can all be on a transcendental level. You know, Prabhupada was transcendental. Real anxiety comes in because we don't have faith in Krishna. And we don't understand, just like it's described here. Everything is being controlled. You know, everything's being, the demigods are controlling everything that's going on in the material world. And for the devotee, our understanding is Krishna's in control of everything. So there needs to be, great enthusiasm. You know, we don't have anxiety to do service. We have enthusiasm to do service. Anxiety comes in when we think, just like even Prabhupada said on book distribution, he said, your service is to go out and do your best to distribute the book. But it's up to Krishna in the heart, a super soul in the heart, who's going to take a book, who's not going to take a book. And we have to see that it's not our efforts. Like he said, we were reading in Prasadam the other day, Bhakti Tirtha Maharaj, he tells that nice story, because he was reading that letter to Prabhupada, and he said Prabhupada was actually disinterested when he was talking about how he was selling books here, and they were going, you know, in the Czech Republic and all these communist countries, and great difficulty. But instead of the usual enthusiasm that Prabhupada had, he seemed disinterested. And Bhakti Tirtha said he started reading louder, because he thought, well, maybe Prabhupada's just not hearing me. This is really amazing stuff I'm saying here, you know. And he starts reading louder, and he started reading louder. And then that's when Prabhupada said, it's Krishna's mercy. You know, in other words, you're not the doer. It's Krishna's mercy that these things are happening. So that's real, you know, that's all these things come together. That's real humility, is understanding I'm not doing anything. You know, Prabhupada never went and sat in that Vyasasana, he looked out and think, look at all this that I've created. And he would never say that. And he would always give credit to his spiritual master, give credit to Krishna, Lord Chaitanya, Gaur Nitai on the altar. His devotee just sees himself as really insignificant. But they work 24 hours a day in devotional service. That's it takes time, of course. We have to become purified through the process itself of chanting, hearing, service attitude to the spiritual master, you know, to other devotees, seeing everyone as my master. All these things take time. And, as these things happen, as we do develop in Krishna consciousness, these things will go on. And, you know, I had a nice, like I said, talking with Prajumna, he was saying so nicely that three things, they all develop at the same time, all not like this, but they're all coming like this. You know, the more you become Krishna conscious, your austerity increases, that detachment from this body, you're eating, you're sleeping. They naturally, they're going to decrease as your attachment increases to Krishna. But at the same time, it's not that you just become detached, you become austere, you become cold and callous. At the same time, your knowledge increases. And as along with your knowledge, your bliss increases. So a devotee has all these things, right? Because he's more attached to Krishna, he's more blissful, he's more happy. He realizes Krishna's controlling everything he's doing. He just has to do his service. He knows what Krishna wants and he does it. But if someone is just austere, sometimes you'll see this in temples, you get the person, he's just austerity, austerity, austerity. But he doesn't seem to have any bliss, you know, not blissful. You know, where you can have a person that he seems, oh, so very blissful, but he doesn't understand the philosophy, he's not practicing any austerities. So any one of these things, they can become, go the wrong way. So that means that's not Krishna consciousness. It's tainted. You know, there's a material consciousness that's in there. Because as we become detached, you don't become detached without becoming attached. You can't. We're always attached. That's the nature of us. We're attached. So we have to become attached to Krishna, attached to Krishna's service. And the more we become attached to that, then these other things, you become disinterested in them. So many times when I was with Prabhupada in the afternoon, because he would take a little nap in the afternoon, and then he would take rest at night. But sometimes when he was going to take his nap, and he would just look at me, just look and say, now I'm going to waste my time. He said, I hate sleeping. He said, I hate to go to sleep. He said, but then he would do it. because the body requires some sleep, you know. But that's how he saw it. He would say, now I'm just going to waste my time. He never wanted to rest. Devotees, all he wants to do is serve, serve, serve. Just like we see our resident Maharaj here. I'm always chastising him. Go to sleep. 10 o'clock at night. Go to sleep. Right? Radhanath Maharaj. He's always up, you know. He wants to stay up. But to take care of the body, we have to do certain things. This body is our vehicle for performing service. And Prabhupada, he was very, very careful about keeping as much as he could his body in tip-top shape so he could continue his service for as long as possible. We're not thinking, I'd just go away, take my next birth and maybe just get out of this material world. This is a nasty place. Devotee doesn't see the nastiness. He sees service everywhere. Prabhupada said, Mayapur is our home. He said, that's our home, Sridham Mayapur. We're Brahma Gaudiya Vaishnavas. Lord Chaitanya. We're all followers of Lord Chaitanya and Lord Nityananda. So Mayapur is our home. He said, the West is for two purposes. What's that for? Who knows? What? Two things you can do in the West, a devotee. Yeah, sense gratification and preaching. That's the only business in the West. This is also the West. This is as far west as you can get in India. So you're also in the West. And it's known, right? Mumbai is the West. It's like just like the West. So if you're not preaching, what are you doing? Sense gratification. Yes, and that's the cause of our misery. Our misery is not because we're doing devotional service. Our misery is we're trying to enjoy. So we have to preach. Otherwise, we should go to Mayapur and live there and just chant. But we're not ready for that. I'm not ready to do that at this time. You know? So we have to preach. And which brings me, I was going to tell one. Oh, yes, go on.
As far as the example of the Vedas being our mother goes, did anybody present the argument to Srila Prabhupada that, well, if you want to determine who your father is, do a blood test, do a DNA sample. That'll be the final word.
We didn't talk about DNA samples and blood tests back in 1972. They weren't so common. Now, that's what I would say. We'd have a DNA. But no, that wouldn't have been the right answer either. There was no right answer for Prabhupada when he wanted to make a point. No such thing as a right answer. In fact, you would be getting more trouble. I learned that on several occasions. When Prabhupada would say something, I would just agree. And he would say, why did you do that? I'd say, I'm a big fool. But then that wasn't a right answer either. Because then don't be a fool, you know. Yes. I still wonder, like, what happened there, you know. The only thing I could think is what I said was that he was genuinely had concern, and he just wanted to stress to me how we have to take these books, what he'd given us. His words had to become our life and soul. Otherwise, we're in danger, you know, we're in constant danger. As soon as you think, well, they say this, and it's true. What truth can there be? A person, they think they're their body. This is the most, see, that's what's so nice in India. In India, now maybe a little less, but in India, Prabhupada would say, any street sweeper, he understands Bhagavad Gita, that we're not this body, that we're spirit soul. But in the West, no one had this understanding. And because of this, you know, Prabhupada would said in the morning walk, this was the one story I was going to tell, in 75, Paramahamsa, myself, was there. Nitai Das. We're all on this morning walk on beautiful Hawaii. You know, it was paradise. Prabhupada said, if there's heaven on earth, he said, it's in the USA. And then he said, and if there's heaven in the USA, it's in Hawaii. It was a very heavenly place, a heavenly planet. But anyway, we're on this morning walk, and in it he starts saying how if one doesn't complete their Krishna consciousness in this life, then next life he could take birth in India. in a nice, pious, devotee family. Well, when he would say that to us, we would become frightened. And we think, I don't want to take birth in India. I had been in India for 1 year, as all I was sick the whole time. You'll see, if you read my stories, I give such a bad impression of India because I had jaundice, I had malaria 3 times. You know, I never wanted to be more than 30 seconds from a bathroom when I was in India because you never knew when you needed one. So he said that, and we all start looking at each other and say, what are we doing practicing Krishna consciousness? We're going to have to take birth in India next life. But that's what he said. So then we're all like poking, you know, we were nonsense. Paramahamsa and myself, we were in Nitai. He wasn't much better at the time. And we're saying, Prabhupada says we have to take birth in India next life. Because we didn't think we were going to complete Krishna consciousness in one life. So then we get into the car, and Prabhupada's he's sitting in the front seat beside the driver, and the three of us are in the back. And they're all like poking me, you know, because they want to find out about this birth in India thing. Like this birth in India. And as much as I didn't ask Prabhupada questions, somehow or other, I was always the advocate when these things came up. So I said, Prabhupada, you know, you were saying on the morning walk that if we don't finish our Krishna consciousness, we have, you know, we get to take birth in India in a pious family. And Prabhupada said, yes. He said, you know, this is very good. You take birth, and it's mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, take birth in devotee family. And we said, well, do we have to take birth in India? He said, India, we said, you know, India is just, you know, India seems like such a difficult place, you know, sometimes. And Prabhupada said, well, now, he said, we have this International Society for Krishna Consciousness. He said, so we can take birth in any devotee family. He said, anywhere in the world, he said, is possible, because devotees are everywhere. And we said, okay, thank you, Prabhupada. We felt relief. We didn't have to take birth in India. But now, as I get older, I see so much how important it is to take birth in a proper... As Prabhupada said, India is still the remnants of Vedic culture is there. And I can see all these devotees coming. It is natural devotees. For us, it was not even natural. Somehow or other, Prabhupada lifted us, inspired us. He made us dance, chant, perform devotional service. He gave us mercy. We had Prabhupada look into our eyes and transform us. Just by his presence, he transformed. Just like Lord Chaitanya made the animals dance. Huh? Prabhupada said he couldn't make the animals chant and dance, but he did. We weren't any different than the animals. Right? We were, you know, eating meat, taking intoxication, as Bhavananda was saying. So much nonsense. We were no better. We weren't living like humans. But here you can see now devotees becoming Vaishnavas in India so much. And it's just so easy. Chant their 16 rounds. They follow the regulative principles. And you'll spend your whole life. Some of you will just be brahmacharis your whole life. Some will become ideal grahastas. Live ideal grahasta life with worshiping the deity. Just doing enough to maintain, giving the rest to help and spread Krishna consciousness. So it would be a great honor to take birth in such a family in India in my next life. So some things we can see as time goes on. So. Anyway, we'll stop here. It's a little late. I'm sorry to take so much time. I brought a couple of books. Somebody wanted a book or two, so I brought a few with me, and I still have a few upstairs. And it's all by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada, as Bhavananda was saying so nicely yesterday, that we're all here. And we always have to keep that in our minds. And Prabhupada was very kind. So Srila Prabhupada ki jai.